author, columnist, managing editor of LibertyNation.com, podcast host and conservative policy advocate.
We dismiss history at our peril.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
There is a new unit of time that will replace the nanosecond, and that is the amount of time it takes for an event to happen and John Kirby to get on the airwaves explaining what Biden really said and meant.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
Today's podcast is sponsored by the Association of Mature American Citizens. It is the only conservative alternative to AARP. Go to amac.us/Carter. Today, I have a very special guest. I will be joined by Professor Gad Saad. You may know him from his very popular YouTube channel. He is a professor at Concordia University and is the author of The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. And guys, if you don't have this book, you need to get it. It is so great. And the reason why I reached out and I was so adamant that we get Dr. Saad on the show was because I saw him on Joe Rogan and I thought, this is the guy that can make sense of our crazy world. And he really, really does. You do not want to miss this interview. Please follow and subscribe. Get all the links at sarahacarter.com. That is sarahacarter.com. And while you're there, sign up for our email list. This way you don't get shadow banned. I like having that email list, folks, so we can stay in touch with one another. And I can also get emails from you, which is fantastic ideas and all the great stuff that you have to say we implement into this show. So thank you very much for all of those emails. I do read them. Folks, imagine a scenario in 2024 where Vice President Kamala Harris is being urged to determine which electoral votes to count and why. Because the Electoral Count Act isn't specific enough. The Presidential Election Project wants to see this change. This is so, so important. I want you to visit www.presidentialelectionproject.com to learn why reform of the Electoral Count Act is so important. The Presidential Election Project believes Congress should clearly define the role of the vice president in counting electoral votes and make clear that the position is ceremonial and is not tasked with determining the outcome of any election. It also wants to raise the threshold required to object to counting states' electoral votes. The bottom line is that it believes states could do their jobs of timely deciding election results, and Congress should respect each state's lawful results. This is a big call to action, folks. I want you to go to www.presidentialelectionproject.com now. Go there now and learn more. Take the first steps in ensuring Kamala Harris can't unilaterally decide the 2024 presidential election. That's www.presidentialelectionproject.com. All right, you know, we are going to be going straight into my interview with Dr. Gad Saad. He is an amazing man. He's the author of The Parasitic Mind, which is a book that I think is phenomenal. I'm flying through the book. It just reads so well. And it, by the way, it gives you the ammunition that you are going to need to fight the lunacy out in our society today. I don't know how you guys feel, but I actually, it's disturbing to me. I feel as though I am being abused constantly by the left and by the Marxists. They tell us to believe in these most ridiculous things. Like, we're not supposed to believe there's a difference between a man and a woman. We know there is scientific proof that there is a difference between us. They want us to believe that men can have babies. No, they cannot. And, you know, they teach this to our children. They're trying to deconstruct the reality of what we are dealing with in our everyday lives, manipulate our minds, manipulate our impressionable children's minds. Why? Well, for the very purposes that Dr. Saad is going to talk to you about, and how, you know, these elitists, these government officials, these Marxist leftists, how they do this in society. And this isn't the first time. This has happened in the past. But the problem is, and I think I'm going to kind of boil it down into a nutshell here, is that we need to stand up and defend our children, defend our right to sanity, defend our right to the truth, And that means calling out these people that are trying to deconstruct everything in the world around us and lie to us about everything in the world around us, or we're going to lose our country and we're going to lose ourselves. We cannot stay silent. Do you remember early on when I was doing the podcast, I would talk to you all the time about, you know, even especially during Trump Russia and what was happening in our nation, is like, we cannot be the silent majority. We cannot be the silent majority. We have to speak up. We have to stand up. We have to defend ourselves against this manipulation effort. And we've never seen it quite this bad. You know, we look in the past, we've had situations in America, yes, that have been difficult, right? In the 1960s, you know, and especially dealing with the Vietnam War and what happened in America and, you know, various different groups that actually were being manipulated and being run by Marxist leftists. We saw bombings in the United States. We saw, you know, we saw issues as well with cartels in the United States, the Italian mob, and, you know, all this kind of craziness that happened. But I've never seen our nation so threatened as it is right now. And the greatest threat to our nation is this ideology that is deconstructing all of us, trying to target our children, targeting our communities, targeting our schools, telling us that what we're seeing is not reality, telling us that our reality is a false reality. You know, turning family member against family member. We can't allow this to happen. And what's even worse, look at what it's doing to our children. Look at what it's doing to the people in our society. Look at how they have reacted to the American dream. I mean, there are so many kids out there right now that believe that this nation is the worst nation on earth. American kids who have been taught this in schools. You know, while we were sleeping at the wheel, right? The car was heading over the cliff and we didn't even pay attention. And our kids were in the back seat and there were some crazy professors in the driver's seat. Folks, we have a lot to be concerned about. We have a lot to be thankful for, but we could lose it. And that is why shortly I'm going to be bringing Gad Saad onto the show. But first, I want to tell you about MyPillow. MyPillow is awesome. And in fact, while I've been at the border today, guess what? I had a MyPillow with me. Why? Because the security team that was with me got a brand new set of MyPillows and they brought it for me so I could take a little nap in the car as we drove all the way. It was about a 4.5 hour drive from Eagle Pass to McAllen, Texas. I was leaning my head up against the window. I slept like a baby. Mike Lindell is a patriot and he's done it again with this blowout slipper sale on all my slippers. Right now, you can save $90, listen to this, on my slippers, and they are so comfortable. They're amazing, and you can even wear them outside. They've got a very thick sole on the bottom. They're not just made for indoors. They're regularly, listen to this, $139.98, but the blowout price right now is $49.98, only with my promo code, okay? Only with my promo code. My slippers come with 4-tier cushioning system. It's a MyPillow patented feel. They've got the comfort memory foam. You can wear them indoor and outdoors, just like I said, and they're made with quality leather suede. Just use the promo code Carter. Go to MyPillow.com/Carter or call 1-800-685-7221 for the My Slippers for only $49.95. While you're there, take advantage of the deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the BOGO extravaganza on bed sheets, MyPillows, and more. Visit MyPillow.com/Carter or call 1-800-685-7221 today for the most comfortable slippers you'll ever own and get Mike's book free. MyPillow.com/Carter or call 1-800-685-7221.
Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la vacuna que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
And without any further delay, I've got Dr. Gad Saad. He's a professor of marketing at the John Molson School of Business at Concordia University. He holds Concordia University Research Chair in Evolutionary Behavioral Sciences and Darwinian Consumption. He is also the author of The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. He is known for applying evolutionary psychology to marketing and consumer behavior. This is just great because it takes us deep into the human mind. He studies this. He understands what is going on in our country for the most part. And he's not just coming on to tell us what's wrong in our country. He's not just coming to tell us what's wrong here. He is in Canada, or what's wrong in Canada for that matter. By the way, they are taxing him and his book like insane amounts, and he's fighting that. I think he is a true, he fights the true American fight right over there in Canada, right? With the taxes. We fight that here as well, but he actually gives us a way to inoculate ourselves and our children against this crazy behavior, against these crazy ideas, and he brings us back to reality. Before I bring Dr. Saad on, he's actually waiting in the wings. This past weekend, he put out a YouTube video. It was explaining how the left's obsession with diversity, inclusion, and equity is killing the scientific method. Here's just a part of that clip.
So just imagine for a second, we went from having the scientific method, which is the greatest epistemological liberator that the world has ever known. It liberates us from the shackles of our personal identities. That's what makes it beautiful. It doesn't matter whether I'm Lebanese Jew. It doesn't matter that I'm ridiculously good looking. What matters is the science approached using the scientific method? Now we don't do it that way. How are you going to incorporate diversity, inclusion, and equity in your literature review, in your theoretical development, in your methodological approach, in your data collection? How are you going to collect, how are you going to analyze the data? Surely you're not going to use inferential statistics, all of which were developed by disgusting, largely heterosexual white males. What about sort of spirit dance? You get the data and you just kind of do like a shamanic spirit dance. That's how you adjudicate data. There's got to be multiple ways. It is simply impossible what is taking place. And everybody just nods and says, la, 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 hopefully the problem goes away. It's not going away. We are reverting to the dark ages epistemologically. It's unbelievable.
You would think that it would be easy. Listening to that, that's just common sense, but there's common sense has kind of gone out the window now, and I don't know how we're going to get it back. Well, I know one person who can help us get it back, and that's Dr. Gad Saad. I'm so happy to have you on the show today, Dr. Saad. Thank you so much for joining the Sarah Carter Show. I know you were on with Joe Rogan. I forgive you for that. So first, but it was such an amazing interview that I had to run and buy your book. The Parasitic Mind. I'm blown away And I'm going to let you talk in just 1 second because I got to get this off my chest. I usually feel like I'm the only person like floating around in this kind of strange upside down world. And then I always run into people that are saying, no, I feel the same way. I feel the same way. And here we have a book, folks. You've got to get this book that actually brings sanity back and makes me feel centered again and makes me understand that what I'm feeling is not wrong. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for those words. And I'm so excited to be here with you. We recently connected on Twitter. It was long overdue that we connected. So I'm so excited to be here.
I know. Yeah, I know. I feel like it's so funny because I'm, you know, it's a different world we live in. We live in such a global world. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that because I think your book goes right into that aspect of like our communication, right, on a global level. And of course, all of the craziness that goes with that. But I almost feel like I know you. I started reading your book. You grew up in Lebanon. I grew up, I left to Saudi Arabia when I was 5 and a half, 6 years old with my father. He worked for Lockheed Martin. My mother was a Cuban immigrant. And I spent 8 years of my life in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and traveling throughout the Middle East and, you know, different parts of Africa and Europe. Yeah. So when I'm reading your book and you're talking about, you know, the Paris of the Middle East, Lebanon, Beirut, it was the Paris of the Middle East. Beautiful. I remember landing there with my father and going into Beirut. And I remember, you know, just how amazing like that time period was. Now, for me, it was, you know, later on in the 70s and, you know, and then and into the 80s. But it was such an incredibly diverse place with so much history. Tell me a little bit about that, because that did formulate who you are today. I mean, right. Growing up in the Middle East and all the experiences that you had.
So we, by the way, before I answer your question, do you speak Arabic?
Khalas, no, I wish. I could say shukran, kif halik, you know, throw out my little words right here and there. Busi, like my, okay. Yeah, I remember that. But I definitely missed out on that part.
So to answer your question, I grew up in Lebanon. I was born there, lived there the first 11 years of my life. We were part of the last group of Lebanese Jews who had steadfastly refused to leave Lebanon. You know, in the Middle East, it's all nice until it isn't, right? So it's everybody's living together and in harmony until you need to put on the running shoes and run real fast because they're going to decapitate you. So we were part of the last group that, you know, we were well entrenched within Lebanese society. My parents were well known. We had a good life. There was always this undercurrent of anti-Semitism in Lebanon, which I discuss in the book, in The Parasitic Mind. But, you know, we were happy. And then the civil war broke out in the mid-70s, in 1975, when it really became impossible to be Jewish in Lebanon. And so we were there the first year of the Civil War, and then luckily were able to emigrate to Canada. My parents, after we came to Canada, kept going back to Lebanon because we still had some business interests. And on one of their return trips to Beirut, they were in 1980, they were kidnapped by Fatah. Some really bad stuff happened to them, but luckily they hadn't been executed. We were able to get them, you know, out. I say we, I had nothing to do with it. I was a 15-year-old kid who knew nothing about what was going on. I only found out what happened to them after they were freed, actually. And so since 1980, no one from my family has returned to Lebanon. Although I long for a day when I can take back my children there, even though I went through some really horrifying childhood trauma, it is still my homeland. I regret, just like how you don't speak Arabic, I regret that my children have not been immersed in the Lebanese culture, in the Arabic language. And so maybe one day, inshallah, we'll go back.
I think what's so fascinating is you talk about, you know, we talk about the history and a lot of people aren't familiar with the history of Lebanon or familiar, for that matter, in America with the history of the Middle East and how rich and how strangely divisive it is and how dangerous and inflammatory it can be just in any moment. It just goes up in flames and it must have been so difficult. But thinking about the thousands of years, I mean, your family is like, I mean, from Lebanon, you are a Jewish family from Lebanon. That means your family had been there from the very beginning of time. And I mean, your father must have been, it must have been so difficult for him to leave, because I read in your book, you know, it was a very difficult decision for your dad. He really wanted you to be a part of that.
Yeah. It was very hard for my parents to kind of acculturate to the Canadian model. So I'll tell you a quick funny story, which I didn't discuss in the Parasitic Mind. So when we first moved to Lebanon and my dad received a few parking tickets, you know, because he had parked somewhere illegally, his first response or reaction was, you know, who's the cop that I need to speak to so that this can go away? And then someone explained to him, well, it doesn't happen like this in Canada. And his reaction was, what kind of barbaric country is this? So even though we had just escaped the barbarism of an incredibly violent civil war where we were under imminent threat of execution every day, at least he understood the parameters of that world. Whereas coming to Canada, which was orderly and you couldn't bribe the policemen, well, that was completely insane. What kind of barbaric society is this? So it took, and that's why my parents kept going back to Lebanon, even after we had emigrated to Canada, because it was very hard for them to let go of this homeland, even though we had gone through such horrific treatment.
Oh, I can imagine. It must have been terrifying for them too when they saw how much they were paying in taxes. Was that terrifying? Because you...
Oh, now you're hitting me at my most raw place. I don't know if you want me to talk about this because it'll be a 4-hour sob story.
No, make it just a quick 2-minute sob story. But that's how you and I connected. I not only did I love the podcast, but I just burst out laughing when I saw, because I know how I would feel, how angry you were at the amount of taxes being taken out.
So think about this, Sarah, right? Look, I'm not suggesting that anyone deserves to pay taxes. Everybody works hard for their money. Everybody puts in the labor. But there is something that is truly existentially diabolical about taxing me on my words, my thoughts, my life story, right? So I went through the horrors of the Lebanese Civil War. I'm now writing about it, but I only own 42% of my personhood, right? So there is something that is truly, you talk about the parasitic mind. What greater parasite is there than having two governmental agencies sipping cognac, smoking a cigar, and saying, you know what? We love that Jew with all of his horror stories from Lebanon. It's so nice that 58%, I'm faking as though I'm smoking a cigar, that 58% of his royalties go to our bank account. And so I'm telling you, I've been walking around for 2 weeks in a complete stupor, unable to comprehend where my money's gone.
Oh, I agree. And when we see where our money goes, even here in the United States, when you see taxpayers saying, well, wait a minute, we didn't agree to this. We didn't agree to send these, you know, tens of billions of dollars, even if it's Ukraine or if it's anywhere. We didn't agree to that. You didn't ask us permission. And I know how you feel when I think about it, that you only get that 42%, that they have more than 50% vested.
Actually, it's even worse. Forgive me for interrupting you. The way it works, I think the federal government takes up to 33%. That's the maximum. The Quebec government takes 25%. That's where the 58 comes from. But then it's also a progressive taxation system. The more money that you make, the more they take, because, you know, we need to punish our intellectuals into financial oblivion. But then if you add sales tax, I pay, I think, 15 or 16. So whatever 42% is left for me, if I go buy food or get a haircut, that 42% is not mine. You tax me another 15, 16, 17%. And then I pay property tax, and then I pay school tax, and then I pay gas tax, and then I pay carbon tax. So by the end of it, out of $100 that I've made, about 30 cents is left to me. So imagine, let's put it in the context of slavery. I understand that people don't like these kind of analogies, but it's a very apt one. A slave from January 1st to December 31st works for free. You own the slave. Well, I work from January 1st to September for free. So am I more a free man or am I more of a slave? Well, certainly on that continuum, I'm much closer to being a slave.
Absolutely. And I love the way you put it, because it's true. Because if you think about the amount of taxes that you're spending, that you're giving up on your hard work, and that the government has the access and the right to that, they say, then of course, you are working for free. You are working for free, Dr. Saad. So exactly. Let me ask you this. With your, let's look at the book, The Parasitic Mind, because you do touch on these issues, like of the government and the narratives. And right now, you know, Elon Musk, I'm sure you're watching what's going on with Twitter and how he's being targeted. We saw how Rogan was targeted. We see how I've been targeted for having either common sense or for speaking against the narrative. It appears that even the United States government believes that it is better apt at disseminating information and gauging whether that information is actually accurate or inaccurate than the normal person, than the regular citizen. It appears that our governments now believe that they are smarter than us, that they can toy with us, that we're supposed to be buying their information, no matter how ridiculous that information is. Even if we decide to question it, we get punished for it. What is going on here?
So let's link it to the parasitic mind. So in the book, I basically argue that in the same way that people can be infected with all sorts of pathogens, whether it be viruses or bacteria or parasites, humans can also be infected with a class of brain worms or, you know, idea pathogens that parasitize our ability to think, right? So, and let me draw here a biological analogy. So if you take something called Toxoplasma gondii, it's a brain worm, it's an actual physical parasite that when it infects the brains of mice, they lose their innate fear of cats and they actually become sexually attracted to the cat's urine, which is not a very good attraction to hold if you're a mouse. Now, why is that happening? It's because the parasite doesn't care about the host's interests. It cares about its own reproductive interests. And therefore, it is parasitizing the neuronal circuitry of its host to its service. And so I use that model, hence the parasitic mind. I use this model to argue that over the past 40 or 50 years, we've had a spawning of these idea pathogens in universities. So it all starts first in the universities, because as Orwell aptly said many years ago, you know, it takes intellectuals to come up with some of the dumbest ideas. I'm paraphrasing. And so these ideas are originally spawned on university campuses, but contrary to what many of my detractors were saying, when they would say, well, Dr. Saad, you're being hyperbolic. Who cares if some of these stupid ideas are in some humanities department in some ivory tower? And I would remind them, maybe prophetically, that these ideas eventually break out of the lab, right? Like they start off in the ivory tower, but then they become our prime minister, right? So in Canada, our prime minister is a walking manifestation of every imbecilic, parasitic idea that you could imagine was spawned on the university campus. Postmodernism, cultural relativism, identity politics, biophobia, the fear of using biology to explain human behavior, militant feminism, social constructivism. So each of these idea pathogens is a departure from reality, none of which can bring down our edifices of reason. But once you put them all together, you end up with what you described about your own condition, which is you can't recognize reality anymore. You don't know what's up, what's down, what's left, what's right. So the book basically is about explaining these idea pathogens, but then offering a vaccine, an inoculation against these disordered forms of thinking.
Prime Minister Trudeau, I think he went to the same, whatever specific class that indoctrinated him. I think it was the same one that we're seeing now in the Biden White House. We're having this exact same problem here in the United States. It was so crazy when I saw they were going to create a Ministry of Truth, a governance board for information here in the United States. I think there were some people that just said, what's going on here? And then having the woman that was singing on Twitter, you know, and I don't even want to go into her right now, but having her be the head of it really showed me that we were being abused mentally. Like they were mentally abusing the public, right? Gaslighting us, telling us that you can't possibly make your own decisions, that we have to have this imbecile running a governance board to tell you how to think, to tell you what to think. It's almost as if you talk about Orwellian, the memory hole, right? Or, you know, dropping everything into a well, right? Take reality, throw it in there. Do you think we are being abused mentally by these people? I mean, we are really, I feel it every single day.
You know, one of the great things about the West, and you know, it often takes immigrants such as myself who've tasted the buffet of other possible societies to remind the Westerners not to take for granted what you have here, right? So if you have a long view of history, much of history has been quite similar in that there is some anointed class. It's a king, it's a feudal lord, it's an emperor who knows more than you, who's appointed by God or the gods, who says, I hold dominion over you. And much of human history has been of that form. And then a miracle happened. That miracle was called the West. And we had a few ideas, foundational values, that created this anomalous little bleep in history where we had true individual dignity, true freedom of speech, true freedom of conscience. And what we're seeing now is reverting back to the default value, right? So there was a couple hundred periods where we had this great experiment. You can call it the United States, or more generally, we could call it the West. And now all of those basal instincts of having an anointed class that can adjudicate what is true or not is now back de rigueur, we say in French, is back in full force, right? And that's why I kept warning people when I was seeing it in academia, because as I said, the disease always starts, these ideological diseases always are spawned in academia. And I was standing on top of the mountain screaming to people, this is going to happen, this is going to come. And I'm not saying it to be gleeful that I was a prophet, but it's because I could see what, right? Most people only see these things when it starts affecting them personally, right? When my child is exposed to CRT, that's when I start getting involved. Until then, it's somebody else's issue. You know, Gadsad can go on Joe Rogan, but it doesn't affect me. Well, guess what? It's going to affect you down the line. And so this Ministry of Truth, I regret to say, is what we've had throughout all of history. Look, in Islam, you know, if you are not a believer, you're a kafir, you're a non-believer. And if you say anything against Islam, you are spreading fitna. Fitna means you're spreading mischief, right? So we need to decapitate your head because this creates social cohesion. Under Marxism, you know, if you propose a genetic theory that is scientifically true, but contrary to the Marxist ideology, we have to send you to a gulag or a re-education camp or a psychiatric institute. So the reflex of Biden to set up a Ministry of Truth is not something novel. It's actually part of what is to be expected in the human repertoire. And regrettably, we had this small window in history where we were free, and I think now we're returning to being shackled.
That's where I wanted to ask you, because this is what terrifies me. Freedom should be the one thing that every young person, that every human being wants to fight for, right? It is the one thing that we are endowed with in a sense of like we can understand that. I don't know if that's philosophically, if it's something not really tangible, but we understand that being free, being able to express ourselves, being able to defend our family, those are essential human rights. At least we believed that. Why do you think it has been so easy for professors, for Marxists, for Islamists, extreme Christians, or anyone to be able to manipulate large groups of people? I guess this is a question been asked since the beginning of time. You wonder why people took the Kool-Aid at Jim Jones in Guyana, right? That he asked them to take. But why are people so ready to give up their freedom and to be like a part of the have someone direct them than the other way around? Why are we so susceptible and some of us aren't?
Yeah, great question. So it depends on which ideological movement we're talking about. So let's focus first. We could do the Islam part after if you'd like, but let's do, you know, why is it so alluring for people to be intoxicated by all of the idea pathogens that I discuss in the parasitic mind. Okay, so let's start with that. Each of those idea pathogens shares one thing in common. They start off with some noble objective, which then gets it metamorphosizes into nonsense in the pursuit of that noble goal. So, example, equity feminism is a great idea. We can both call ourselves equity feminists. We don't believe that there should be institutionalized reasons why women should be treated differently under the law. And therefore, both you and I are equity feminists. Militant feminism then says, well, in the desire to eradicate the patriarchal status quo, let's promulgate the idea that there are no biological differences between the sexes. It's only due to social construction, because then that will make it easier for us to eradicate the sexist patriarchal status quo. So in the service of what originally seemed like a noble goal, I will murder truth. I will rape truth in the service of that goal. This is what is called consequentialism, right? So let me compare now two ethical systems. Consequentialism is, for example, if I say it's okay to lie if I'm trying to spare someone's feelings. So if my spouse asks me, do I look fat in those jeans? And if I want to be married for a long time, then I will lie and say, of course not, sweetie. You look gorgeous. I've never seen you look better. So I engaged in a fib, but she because of a greater consequentialist goal, right? But deontological ethics is absolute truth. Deontological would be, it is never okay to lie. Now, for most things, most of us are consequentialists because we always have to weigh, you know, so for example, if you were under Nazi Germany and someone came to you and said, are there Jews hidden here? You might want to lie to save their, you know, the people that you're hiding. But when it comes to the truth, you should always be deontological, meaning that you never abdicate a millimeter of the truth in the service of a consequence, right? So, for example, I'm not going to say there are no innate sex differences between men and women when clearly there are, simply because I'm trying to eradicate the patriarchal status quo. So therein lies the problem. Each of those idea pathogens are alluring to people because they want to feel as though they're compassionate, they're empathetic, right? I want to support transgender rights. Why don't you want to support transgender rights? Well, okay, I'm also for transgender rights, but I also don't think that boys too can menstruate. So I can chew gum and walk at the same time. I could be socially liberal in supporting transgender rights without saying that boys too can menstruate.
But you can't do that now. But now you can't do that because if I say boys can't menstruate or have babies, all of a sudden I am banned on Twitter, or I'm, you know, I violated Facebook standards because I said a man can't have a baby. Well, a man cannot have a baby. Even if the person thinks they're a man and grows a beard and a mustache and gets pregnant, they still have to have a uterus. You know, I mean, there's no way. I don't think have you ever met a man who could have a baby? I've never met a man who could have a baby.
Well, I don't know. Maybe if some of your listeners who've heard me mention this on other shows, forgive the repetition. I might have even mentioned it on the latest Joe Rogan show, and I do discuss in the parasitic mind. In 2002, I went out with a former doctoral student of mine for dinner because he had just defended his doctoral dissertation. And we were going out to dinner, myself, him, my wife, and his date for the evening. And so prior to going out for the evening, he called me to kind of give me a heads up and said, look, the lady that I'm bringing for the dinner date tonight, she's a graduate student in postmodernism, women's studies, and cultural anthropology, to which I answered, okay, so the holy trinity of bullshit. But then, of course, I understood what he was saying. He wanted me to be on my best behavior. I said, oh, I got you. We're going to have a great night. Don't worry. I'm going to be cool, which, of course, was a complete, total lie. So about halfway through the evening, I turned to the lady in question. I'm going to come to the pregnant men in a second. I turned to the lady in question. I said, oh, I hear you're a student of postmodernism. So there are no universal truths, right? Of course, other than the one universal truth that there are no universal truths. She says, yes, no universal truth. I said, well, you know, I'm an evolutionary psychologist, so I do think that there are human universals. Do you mind if I take a shot at proposing a universal and you could tell me how I'm wrong? She goes, yeah, go for it. I said, is it not? This is 2002, Sarah. So talk about prophetic.
Wow.
Okay. Is it not true that only women bear children within Homo sapiens, within humans? Is that not universal? Could I not take that to the bank? She looked at me with utter abject disgust and said, no, it's not true. I said, it's not true that only women bear children? How so? She said, well, there is some peoples in Japan, off some Japanese island, wherein within their folkloric mythological realm, it is the men who bear children. So by you restricting it to the biological realm, you know, that's how you keep us barefoot and pregnant. So after I recovered from the mini stroke I had at facing her imbecility, I said, okay, well, let me take a slightly less controversial and corrosive example other than something as poisonous as saying that only women can bear children. So let's look at one with, you know, cardinal directions. So is it not true since time immemorial that sailors have relied on the premise that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? Is that not true? So there she used something from Jacques Derrida, who's one of the big postmodernist bullshitters. He developed the field of deconstructionism. Language creates reality. And so there she used the trick. She said, well, what do you mean by east and west? And what do you mean by the sun? That which you call the sun, I might call dancing hyena. I mean, literally, those were her words. I said, well, fine. Then the dancing hyena rises in the east and sets in the west. And she said, I don't play those label games. Now, why do I keep repeating this story over and over? Because it perfectly captures the parasitized nature of those people. If I can't meet you somewhere in the Venn diagram of sense making, whereby we could have a common reality where we can agree that women bear children and there is east and west and there is the sun, if those are issues of contention, are you any surprised that half the people can't talk to one another? That's why it's parasitic.
That's a brilliant way of putting it. And it leads me to this question of, you know, the family, right? And our children and our society and our construct. And maybe I'm going way out here, but, you know, one of the big issues is in Marxism, and I know this from my mother, you know, coming from Cuba in the late 1960s to America, was this idea of separating the child from the family, right? So if you deconstruct, and what we're seeing with CRT, what we're seeing with all these teachers now, if you deconstruct everything in a child's world so that nothing makes sense, because I'm already feeling like I know what makes sense. I'm fighting through the bullshit, right? I'm fighting through it and saying, no, that's bullshit. I'm not going to buy it. I don't care what you say. But if you have a child and you mold them 8 hours a day in the school system, parents really don't know what's going on. They're working. Eventually, you're going to have somebody who thinks antithetically to the way the parents probably think and the way the society is constructed, right? Is this how they win? Is this the parasite that we now have to fight, that even our own children will, if not caught early on, will turn against us?
Absolutely. Let me draw a great analogy from when I lecture in consumer psychology. So in one of my courses, when I'm talking about consumer behavior, I ask the students, what do you think is a moral or ethical or legal framework that can help us adjudicate the following issue? When is it okay to advertise to children, right? I mean, right? And there are clear laws that vary from country to country, but the general argument, at least from a psychological perspective, is that you should never target a child with advertising content when they don't yet have the cognitive ability to recognize that they are under a persuasive intent, right? So you understand what I mean? So when I know that you are trying to sell me something, then I could organize my thinking that I can build a defense against your persuasive intent. And it turns out, we know this from developmental psychology, below a certain age, children actually are unable to recognize that. So the academic argument is that whatever that age is, let's call it 8 or whatever it is, it varies from country to country, but there is an age where children are now able to recognize that an ad is meant to convince me to do something, buy this or choose that, right? So imagine that we are so careful to not sell chewing gum to children under the age of 10 or cereal, but I can go to a transgender to tell you how to, what all those very personal things that should be left to the discretion of the parents. But I really want to get to the kindergarten kids, like the quote, don't say gay bill in Florida, which had nothing to do with don't say gay. I think the reason why the ideologues were upset is exactly because of your question, Sarah, which is, if I really need to make sure that the parasitic garbage is really deeply burrowed within the neurons of your child's brain, I got to get to that brain really early because they don't yet have the armament to argue against it. Now, what would be a solution against this? Have parents who offer the inoculation. And I'll give you a great funny story from my home, right? My children are lucky in that they have the grand inoculator who is deworming their brains, right? So they can't be, they're immune to this shit. So I'm going to give you a funny story that happened. My son now is 10, but this was last year, he was 9. My wife was going with my daughter to do you know what a mud run is? Like, it's like a course. It's a race where an obstacle course. And, you know, he's a kid. He was very, but it was only for girls. And so he was very, female. And so he was very frustrated that he couldn't participate. So he looked at me, daddy, with a twinkle in his eyes. He said, well, why couldn't I just self-identify as a girl and run in it, daddy? And I said, I love you, son. What did he do there, right? He used sarcasm and satire. He recognized the lunacy. Now, again, this is not me making fun of people who have gender dysphoria. This is a real condition, and those folks should be treated with all dignity that everybody else deserves. But to then argue that a 240-pound, 6'4" guy could suddenly say, I'm a girl, and shut your mouth. He's just as much of a girl as Sarah Carter, and he has absolutely no morphological, physiological, anatomical, behavioral differences from Sarah is insane. So again, we could be kind and empathetic without murdering truth.
I agree. And I feel the same. And I love that story with your son. That is brilliant. I feel that way with my children. I feel like we've inoculated them without even realizing we were inoculating them, because my kids just, they can't even fathom what's going on. Like, they're just like us. They're just, and they range in all ages. I have a 9-year-old daughter too. And we have, our kids go all the way up to 31, believe it or not, from 31 to 9 years old. So yeah, we've got, big secrets out, guys. No, I'm just joking. So we have a big age range, you know? And the thing is that I want them to be free thinkers. I want them to make up their own minds. I want them to respect, their peers and the people around them. But I don't want them to buy into this ideological, I'm going to say it, bullshit that really is dangerous and detrimental to society. It's detrimental to their freedom. It's detrimental to the future of a free republic. Like the United States of America, or to any nation that is based on freedom, because it gives all the power to basically one group, the elitists. It eventually turns into that. How do we stop that? How do we change that? What do we do?
So one of the things I talk about in the last chapter, which is kind of a call to action, is I use the imagery of the honey badger, and I implore people to activate their inner honey badger. And so let me explain for those of you who may not know what. So the honey badger has been ranked zoologically as the fiercest animal in the world, right? It is the size of a small dog, and yet it could withstand an attack of 6 adult lions in the African savanna. How can it do that? Because it is insane. It is so fierce. It is so ferocious that the lions look at it and say, okay, I don't want a part of that action, right? Well, so what does it mean to be activate your inner honey badger? I don't mean, this is not a call to violence, but it's a call to activating your ideological defenses, right? So if you have a set of principles that you can articulate a strong defense of those principles, then you have to find your spine. You don't be an invertebrate, find where your spine is. Or if you forgive the slightly vulgar colloquialism, grow a pair, have testicular fortitude. If you look at what Christopher Rufo has done over the past year, he came out of nowhere, right?
He wasn't a fancy professor at some fancy school. It fell on his lap, this whole CRT stuff. He became the central repository of all things anti-CRT. He activated his inner honey badger. And now look how much he's emboldened parents to go to these school meetings, these board meetings, to voice their opinion. So there's nothing magical about how you redress the situation. You have to get involved. It's kind of like saying there is a band of really bad guys who are coming into our country to steal our resources and kill us. What should we do? Well, how about you fight, right? You have to fight back, right? I mean, that's called history. History is laden with one group of people wanting what the other group of people have, but the other group of people are not willing to give up their beautiful women or their oil or their resources. So we now are in an ideological battle. There's a bunch of folks who would like to parasitize all of us, including our children, with a set of really dreadful ideas that are anti-enlightenment, anti-freedom, anti-science, anti-reason. And there is no alternative other than you saying, I'm not having it. You can't diffuse the responsibility on Gadsad because, you know, he has broad shoulders. I will just send him a nice email to remind him what a hero he is. Because here's what happens in every one of those emails, Sarah. Dear Dr. Saad, I love you, and here are the 7 reasons why I love you. Now, here's the ending sentence. This is the one you have to remember. And please, if you decide to read my email on your show, don't mention my name. And so I write back and I say, thank you very much for your kind words, but if you forgive me for saying so, do you not think that the last sentence of your email is exactly why we are in this problem? And usually that jolts them because they're not expecting such honesty from me, right? So it's cowardice, it's apathy, it's diffusing responsibility on others, right? I'm busy preparing for my daughter's wedding today. I've got to pick up the groceries. Let someone else worry about this. Now, people will write to me and say, well, okay, I'd love to participate, but I don't have your platform. But nobody's telling you to have Joe Rogan's platform. We could each affect change within the small sphere of influence that we each have, right? If your professor says something that's insane, don't sit quietly, challenge them politely. If someone on Facebook posts something that you think is grotesque, challenge them politely. Just get involved. Now, if you get involved and he gets involved, and if we all get involved, we'll get rid of this garbage by next Tuesday. The silent majority hates this stuff. It's not as though, you know, the blue-haired Taliban are 99% of university campuses. It's just a few of them that keep the rest of us in check, right? And here's an analogy that I'd like to draw for your listeners and viewers. How many hijackers did it take on 9/11 to alter the landscape of New York City? Was it 190 million Muslim terrorists? Was it 190,000? Oh no, it was 19 people who had a lot of fervor, a lot of ideological commitment, who said, you know what? These two buildings have to go. So you don't need a million morons on campuses to keep the rest of us in check. But if we all find our unified voice together and say, we're tired of your nonsense, the problem will magically go away.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I say this all the time. You know, there is nothing noble about being the silent majority. You have to speak up. You have to stand up for your principles, because that'll show you that you're not the only one, that there's people all around you. And by the way, those 19, they not only took down those two buildings and of course the Pentagon and the other plane that crashed, but they kept us in chains literally for 20 years. And we are still in those same chains.
We're still taking off our shoes when we go through the security stuff.
Exactly. We're taking off our shoes. We're letting people frisk us. They're putting hands wherever they want. It's like, stop this. Stop this madness, because we're allowing, you know, I feel like the crazy people are running the institutions, right? And I hate saying that's probably not, because you're a psychologist, you probably don't like me using this word or these phrases, but so we could find something different. But it's like the insane is running the asylum. Is that a better way of saying it? I feel that way. And I don't want us to allow that to happen, because you're right. Throughout history, we have seen when people, good people, do nothing, right? When good people do nothing, then it's over.
Exactly.
We've seen
right.
that throughout history.
Exactly.
And
right.
Do you think there's a way we're going to get out of this?
There is. So, of course, you know, activating your inner honey badger is one. Next, what I'd like to do is
explain how we seek truth, right? So when you are presented with all sorts of conflicting information, how can I navigate through all the labyrinth of nonsense to be able to construct an argument that says this is true, this is false? Can I do that in about 5 minutes?
Yes, I definitely want to hear that. We'll do it in just a moment. Stay with us.
Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la vacuna que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20. Si tienes ciertas afecciones crónicas como
enfermedad cardíaca,
asma,
diabetes,
y tienes 19 años o más,
52,
36,
42,
puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20, vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
Dr. Saad, welcome back. Go ahead and make the point you were going to make before we had to take the break.
So in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, I talk about something called nomological networks of cumulative evidence. So it's a mouthful. So let me explain it. So let's suppose I wanted to prove to you, Sarah, that toy preferences have a sex specificity, right? Boys prefer certain toys, girls prefer certain other toys, and that those toy preferences are not socially constructed. They are actually an indelible part of our biology. How would I go about doing that, right? Now, the reason why I picked that example is because it is a classic one that social constructivists use. Social constructivists are folks who say everything is due to a social construction. There are no biological imperatives, okay? We are born tabula rasa, empty slate, and it's only socialization that makes us who we are. So why does little Johnny play with G.I. Joe? It's because his sexist parents taught him that. Why does little Linda play with the pink doll? It's because their sexist parents are imposing those arbitrary gender roles on them. So now what I want to do is actually prove that that's false, to demonstrate that no, there are biological reasons. So now what I'm going to do, I'm going to build a nomological network of cumulative evidence that supports my position. Now, what does that mean? I'm going to get you data from across cultures, from across time periods, from across animals, from across disciplines, from across frameworks, all of which will triangulate to proving my position. So let me give you examples of that. So I can show you from developmental psychology that children who by definition are too young to be socialized, in other words, they haven't yet reached the cognitive developmental stage to be socialized, and those little boys and little girls are already expressing those toy preferences. So that already is putting a coffin in the social constructivism idea pathogen. But I'm not going to stop there. That's just one of the boxes of my nomological network. Then I'm going to get you data from rhesus monkeys, from vervet monkeys, and from chimpanzees. So those are not human infants. And I'm going to show you that those animal cousins of ours exhibit the same sex specificity of toy preferences. Now it's starting to make you look pretty bad, social constructivist person. But I'm not going to stop there. Now I'm going to get you data from sub-Sahara Africa so that you don't say, oh, but that's just because it's a Western thing. So I'm going to precisely go to cultures that are from completely different non-Western standards and show you that their children exhibit the same toy preferences. So then you're going to come to me and say, but Professor Saad, those are all contemporary cultures. I'm going to say, I'm not finished with my nomological network. Now I'm going to get you data from 2,500 years ago from ancient Greece and ancient Rome, where on funerary monuments, on mausoleums where children are depicted playing, they're depicted playing using the same toy preferences as we have today. So what have I done, Sarah? I have brought you data from across cultures, across time periods, across animals, across disciplines. I'll do one more, although the network is much bigger because it's a really cool one. I can bring you data from pediatric endocrinology, where I can show you that little girls who suffer from congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is a endocrinological disorder that masculinizes little girls. So little girls who suffer from this endocrinological disorder have toy preferences that are like those of boys. So look what I've done. I've put the epistemological noose around your neck. I have, metaphorically speaking, hung you dry. Why? I didn't need to emote louder than you. I didn't need to get more hysterical. I didn't need to get on Twitter and scream louder than you. I simply calmly built the nomological network and then watched as you shut your mouth in utter defeat. This is what allows me to go into rooms or on social media with huge platforms and walk with the assuredness and swagger that I do without fearing of being canceled, because it's going to take someone with really convincing evidence to be able to eradicate the nomological network that I've built. Now, here's the hiccup to what I just said, Sarah. It takes a lot of effort to build this nomological network, right? So if I'm trying to convince you, Sarah, but you're going, la, 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 I don't want to hear it, and you don't grant me the courtesy to at least present to you the nomological network, then my vaccine can't work. But as long as you are honest enough to meet me somewhere where at least you grant me the courtesy to build you the network, I'm going to drown you in evidence. So I think that people have to have that reflex. They may not be fancy professors, you know, the evolution psychologists, but they have to be able to put in the work when they are adjudicating through these issues. If you want to know whether Islam is peaceful or not, don't listen to George Bush or to Barack Obama. Build your nomological network, as I did in Chapter 7, that will definitively tell you whether Islam preaches brotherly love or not. And so if we apply that kind of discipline to all of the hot button issues that afflict our society, then we will have much better discourse between us.
I think that's a brilliant way of putting it. And the only thing that frightens me when I think of, like, this is completely logical, this is how we should look at things, this is how we should view our world, and if you want to base it on science, let's do it on science. Let's get the evidence and present the evidence. But we are dealing with a world now that, unfortunately, doctor, I mean, I am hoping and praying that we can bring all of this evidence forward, that we can show people, show our young people what's right, what's wrong, you know, looking at things in basics, you know, basics, fundamental basics here, and presenting those truths. But I really fear that you're right. The people are putting their fingers in their ears and going, la, 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 la. And they are not allowing the people with common sense to speak. And at the very beginning of this interview with you, I talk about it being abuse. And we use the word gaslighting a lot now. And I feel that it's a great word for what's happening, because we are being told lies, flat out lies, and being asked to believe in them as truths. And that is a very difficult thing to do when you're somebody who can see through it and you're just like throwing your hands up in the air going, I don't know what's going on here, but I feel like I live in crazy town.
And those lies are not just a philosophical conversation about the truth. Bad ideas have real world consequences, right? There is a downstream effect. And so I'll give you two examples, one more microscopic and more intimate and one broader. A few years ago, the same son and I were watching something and they were doing, you know, toxic masculinity and the future is female. And he looked at me with the innocence of the child that he is. And he said,
Daddy, is there something wrong with boys? And it broke my heart, right? Because he had been exposed to the pathologizing of half a human species. We are a sexually reproducing species. There is a phenotype called male and a phenotype called female. In the quest to elevate half of the species called women, to pathologize the other half is probably not a good idea. So the fact that he asked me that question, I actually did a sad truth clip on my channel, on my podcast, speaking to that incident. And so, of course, I had to assuage his concern that, of course, son, boys are fine and girls are, right? So that's one little, so that bad idea of toxic masculinity being constantly repeated to 7 and 8 and 10-year-old children is not a way that you want to elevate the personhood of a young child. So that's one. Let me do a second one that's a bit broader. So now in universities, as you may know, Sarah, and I discussed this in the book, there is a mandatory diversity, inclusion, and equity, or what I call DAI, right? I organize the letters properly because it literally is a death cult. It's where meritocracy goes to die. It's where reason goes to die. It's where individual... For those of you who don't know, diversity, inclusion, and equity is basically arguing for always equality of outcomes, right? Why aren't there non-binary, transgender, Muslima in the math department at Brown University? It could only be because there's systemic bigotry against non-binary, Muslima, transgender people. There can't be any other possible explanation for that. And therefore, let's set up systems to create equality across everybody. So now how does that manifest itself in the day-to-day running of science? Well, when you now apply for a science grant, so I want to do a study looking at the hormonal effects, so the menstrual cycle effects on women and how it affects their consumatory behavior. So I want to put, I've already done that research, but let's suppose I was putting together a grant for that. Well, in the past, the grant would be, here is why this is an important scientific problem. Here is why I need this money. Here is what I hope to solve in terms of the evidence that I'm going to collect, blah, blah, right? You're pitching why this is an important scientific problem. Today, you have to put at the front of the grant, how is your grant going to adhere to DAI principles? But now it's no longer just, oh, I'm going to make sure to hire a non-binary transgender indigenous person. But now at every step of the scientific process, in the literature review, in the data collection, in the data analysis, you have to explain how you're going to be sensitive to DAI principles. That is literally insanity, because the scientific method, what makes it liberating, what makes it the incredible epistemological miracle that it is that it frees us from our identity markers, right? There is no Lebanese Jewish way of doing evolutionary psychology. There is no indigenous way of doing mathematics. There's just evolutionary psychology. There is just mathematics. I don't give a shit what your sexual orientation is, what your skin hue is. That's why science is democratic. And now we're returning to the epistemological dark ages where my scientific credence will be determined by whether I play along the DAI principles. It's perfectly anti-scientific. So these bad ideas are not just esoteric things that we talk about on the Sarah Carter Show. They have real life consequences, and it's truly devastatingly shocking what's happening in our universities.
And I couldn't agree with you more on that. And when you talked about your son, I thought about all the women that I ran into several weeks ago that were protesting outside of the Supreme Court. And this has nothing to do with whether or not someone is pro-choice or pro-life. It had to do with the way they were reflecting on themselves as women. And I was stunned at how some of the women that I was dealing with there either had psychological issues or really hated themselves. Some of them, one woman told me that she wished her mother would have had the option for abortion so that she could have been aborted. She had a horrible life and should have been aborted from the beginning. I thought that was an interesting argument. I know it was crazy, right? I know it's just, wow. You would never think that another human being would think that way. And then I had another girl tell me who seemed to be very reasonable, was at George Washington University, seemed like a very nice girl. When I went up to talk to her, I asked her, okay, where for you is the line when you're dealing with an issue such as abortion? Where for you would be the final line? And she said, there isn't one. I go, wait, I don't understand. What do you mean? And I said, well, 9 months into the pregnancy, I mean, you would have an, she goes, if that baby is connected to me, it's not a baby. It's connected to me. I can get rid of it whenever I want. And I said, well, after the birth, maybe, if there's something wrong with, she goes, absolutely. That should be between me and my doctor. I said, no, that's murder. If it, you know, if it's a full child coming, I mean, so, but they, but their argument was that they have all the rights, that it, that, that a child, it almost seemed to them that a child was a problem, no longer a gift or something special that the female species does. I couldn't understand that they felt that way about themselves. And that's what scares me. When we no longer even have that respect for ourselves, when we no longer can find that line, definitive line, that we've lost something. And I'm praying that your inoculation helps everyone. I mean, The Parasitic Mind is a phenomenal book. I know everybody out there who's listening to me right now will want to read it. I can't thank you enough for being on the show. I probably spent more time with you than you expected, but I appreciate all the time you gave. I hope you come back on the show.
Anytime.
I am so grateful to have had Dr. Gadz out on the show because, guys, we need people that are going to give us solutions, not people that are just going to tell us about the problems. And I think it's a warning. I think, you know, he said he's been warning people for a long time. This is a warning. We need to wake up. 2024 cannot come fast enough. But remember, the November elections are here. It's up to us as citizens of this country to stand up for truth, to stand up for the fundamental foundation of our nation and our Constitution. And we can't do that if we're the silent majority. We need to speak up and we can't be afraid because remember, there are so many more of us. It doesn't mean that we're not going to listen to people. It just means we're not going to buy their bullshit. Thank you so much for joining the Sarah Carter Show. I am so happy to have you here with me. You know, we are together. We're going to make a difference in this country. God bless you. God bless this great nation. And God bless the great state of Texas. Today, I'm joined by Rebecca Weber, the CEO of the Association for Mature American Citizens. It's also known as AMAC. Can you share a little bit with the audience about your father, Dan Weber, and how he founded AMAC and why?
My father formed AMAC after he recognized that the AARP really was not representing his values. And those values were really faith, family, and freedom. And my father believed in America's greatness. He believed that there was what he described as a cultural shift occurring in our country. He thought that the very, very foundation, the Constitution, was being disregarded. And we saw that the power of government was growing and individual freedoms were diminishing, were being threatened. And to get more specific was in 2006 when he said to me that he was canceling his AARP membership. And I said to my father, why would you do that? And he said, well, they've just named Harry Belafonte Man of the Year. And he went on to say that Harry Belafonte had commented to Hugo Chavez saying that George W. Bush was the greatest terrorist threat in America. And my father said something is wrong with that. So he saw the AARP make this sharp left turn. And that was when he said, let's form AMAC. And I said, let's do it.
Rebecca, thanks so much for being with me today. I'm honored to have you and AMAC as a sponsor for the Sarah Carter Show. You know, for more information, folks, visit AMAC.us/Carter. Hey guys, we know it's hard to keep up with all the news these days, but don't worry because we're here to talk and laugh about it all. There's a baby formula shortage, but yet the administration is sending loads of it to the border. Psaki has left the White House, and BLM is being exposed for spending millions on things that have nothing to do with their movement. Hey, it's the Chicks here from the Chicks on the Right podcast. Download and subscribe to our daily podcast to hear us pick apart and pick on the news of the day. Politics to pop culture, nobody's safe, but it's all fun. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.